He was ordained in 1949. He suffered one great tension. And it was a tension that he only had relieved occasionally in his life. While rumors were spreading all over this land, we all heard them. Merton wanted to leave. Merton had left. Merton had abandoned the religious life. The implication behind all of these rumors was that he'd had enough of it. What few people understood was that the suffering and the conflict and the tensions involved in Merton's life during those years, he never left, of course. Had he left, it would have been to go to a place of deeper solitude and more perfect silence. His vocation developed in the area of silence and solitude, so that his unhappiness, his chief unhappiness, came from what he felt was a physical inability to live up to the deepest part of his vocation, his monk. I needn't tell you that Seven Story Mountain made him a very famous man. This introduced a whole second set of tensions within him. When you become a Trappist, when you develop a vocation of that stature, you feel that you can only thrive in it in an atmosphere of absolute truth, absolute clarity. Merton very quickly came to learn that fame was a frightful burden. It remained a burden with him through the rest of his life. His output became tremendous after Seven Story Mountain. He resumed the writings of his private journals. Merton himself said that he was a person who could only think on paper. I've said that he really couldn't scratch his head without writing at least two paragraphs about the technique of scratching one's head. He wrote everything in his journal. One of the great, great blessings of my life has been that I've been privileged to read those journals, something that I didn't even know existed really when I accepted the invitation to write the biography. In those years between his ordination to the priesthood, his growing celebrity as a writer, as a monk, as a spiritual thinker, he was clinging tenaciously to the idea that he was not a good community man, that he had to learn from a kind of solitude which meant physical isolation. Actually, there's a great solitude in that kind of monastic community, especially during the time of the rule of silence. But his needed to be a more profound solitude. As you will recall, when he went in, even when he wrote Seven Story Mountain, and in the several writings immediately thereafter, his conversion was such an overwhelming experience for him that he tended to denigrate the world, and he tended also to be very intolerant of people with different religious beliefs. This began to expand. until finally at the end, of course, he was embracing the whole world. In the early and middle 60s, when one eye was always on the lookout for that place where he might lead a life of deeper silence and deeper solitude, with Aggiornamento, even in the early 60s, the idea of a Trappist living a hermit life was something not to be mentioned. It would have been a scandal. It would have been a horror. A very funny thing happened in 1964. Dom Damasus Winzen, who was the abbot of Mount Saviour Monastery near Elmira, New York, was going to see the Holy Father, and he sent a message that he would like to have Merton to write a set of guidelines about monastic renewal that he could personally place into the hands of the Pope. I recently discovered this document, and the reason I say it's funny is because Merton was really pleading his own cause. He'd begun to think about the hermit life. He'd found some obscure hermits in the early history of the order. He was working on this idea of a hermit vocation within the Trappist community. And in this set of guidelines that he wrote to the for Dom Damasus to hand into the Pope, he said this. He said that abbots should now be open, that we should not have just the absolute hidebound monolithic structure of the community life, that abbots should be open to special vocations with special experiments, at least let them be attempted. If they fail, all right. Because this was at the time when a building had been put up on top of a hill about a half a mile from the abbey proper. It had been put up because Merton, in his growing celebrity and in his growing list of personal contacts with men of other religions, he was doing an enormous amount of what we now consider ecumenical work. It was felt that religious leaders who were not Catholic and who came there to see him and to have conferences with him might feel it some slight disadvantage being housed actually in the guest portion of the abbey. And so this was a nice little concrete block building that was put up in the hills where they could go and sit around and talk. The abbot was beginning to let Merton ease into that at times when there weren't ecumenical conferences, and then he would let him. He was novice master, he had his duties at the abbey, but he began to let him go up there to do some of his work, to read, to meditate. And slowly this worked into a situation where Merton was simply spending more and more time up there. In 64, the abbot allowed him to start sleeping up there, but he had to come down to take care of his classes, take care of the novitiate, and also to say his mass. So he was sleeping there. He was moving into the first modern day hermit experiment in the Trappist order. And he was moving into it in a way that really revitalized his life and his enthusiasms. You must remember that by this time, Merton was a very famous human being. People sought him out on everything. He had written already by the mid-60s on topics of highly controversial and great human concern. He'd written very deeply on matters of racism. He'd written very deeply matters of peace, nuclear warfare, and so forth. And he was mostly unhappy with what he had written. He had become a figure that everyone wanted to quote. There was a side to Merton that was the real side, which was a side of the most profound kind of humility. He felt a constant sense of responsibility about saying things just because he was Merton, without any chance or very little chance of giving them the kind of study that they ought to have. He had trouble, as he said, whenever he spoke. His journals of that period are full of self-reproach. He said, "Why can't I keep my mouth shut?" He said, "I'm a writer. I think with a pen in my hand. I cannot think off the top of my head." So at the time when he was becoming the most famous, he himself was very seriously retrenching from public utterance. You have an extraordinary portion of his life here, because for those years in the early 60s, he was becoming deeply immersed in studies of Eastern religion, Zen, Tao, Sufism. He spent those 5 years between 60 and 65 doing that extraordinary transliteration, if you can call it that, of the way of Chuang Tzu. And his journals are very, very fascinating to read at this point, because everyone is pushing him to speak, to be heard, to use his influence. And he was falling deeper and deeper into a kind of spiritual and internal connection with the ideas of men like Chuang Tzu. Chuang Tzu said things that hit Merton very, very deeply. He said that sense of achievement is the beginning of failure, and that fame is the beginning of disgrace. And Merton already believed that. Chuang Tzu says, in Merton's words, that the goal of an authentic search of truth is to become a nobody, because a nobody can be universal. Merton himself said that he disappeared into the monastery not to get away from the world, but to become a no one so that he could be everywhere to all men. He became very preoccupied also with the contradistinction between what he called the ideal self and the actual self. After he published The Way of Chuang Tzu, he was allowed to go and live permanently, or for a year's experiment as a hermit. The first 6 months of that time was perhaps the most gloriously happy time of his life. He was now alone. He was now able to have solitude and silence with no intrusions. He was now able to lead a life of utter simplicity, provide for himself, chop his own wood, heat his cabin with the wood from the fireplace, for the fireplace, prepare his own meals. And he began to learn what I myself feel that only solitude can teach. I mean total uninterrupted solitude. And of course, one of the things that he became enormously preoccupied in that, once he sank into it, once he spent long times alone, was this contradistinction between the ideal self and the actual self. He began to become highly sensitized to what he felt was the falsity of the image that people made of him. And this is certainly a very, very real problem. I suppose all religions have it to a certain extent. A very famous religious of his sort, his rich, complex human personality, had it to a point of agony. He felt that almost everyone who came to see him came with a preconceived image of a kind of neo-desert father, holy mystic. One of the things that solitude taught him was to be open to all reality. I suppose every person who, about whom the public makes an image, has constantly to do battle between that image and the public's expectations of him to act in a certain way and his own recognition of his own reality as a human being, as a person who has trouble sleeping, as a person who, living in that kind of primitive life, had to be preoccupied with going out and chopping the ice on the rain barrel that, from the roof of his hermitage, so that birds and animals could have drink. A person who had even to be preoccupied with whether or not it was worth fixing that cup of coffee when you had to go and chop the ice on the rain barrel to get water to wash the coffee pot. These are things that, for a hermit, become immeasurably instructive, and they allow you to have very few illusions about yourself, if you have any sense of honesty at all. Another of the things that he was discovering, again, as I say, I believe you can only discover these things in solitude, was that there was no hierarchy of values insofar as the chores, the labor, the day's work. He came to call all of these things the rituals, and all of it was prayer for him. The ritual, as he said, of washing the dishes, of gathering the water, of chopping the wood, of sweeping the cabin, of trying to keep his books and papers halfway dusted. All of these things were part of an activity that was on a very high level. You couldn't prefer the one to the other. Sense of time was lost. He became profoundly immersed at this time in Camus's idea of the absurd man. The absurd man in Camus's concept was the man who had to live in despair because he lived in the moment with no consolation from the recollections of yesterday and no consolation of hope for the future. Merton himself dwelt upon this idea of the absurd man in relation to his hermit existence, and he made one distinction, which I think is a very important one and a very revealing one. He said the difference between himself as the absurd man and the Camus idea of the absurd man was that in Camus the absurd man had to live in despair, whereas he said, without contaminating my present with future anticipations or with facile religious consolations, still do not live in despair, because there is in me a hope which is somehow akin to a kind of profound sense of adoration. He was sensitizing in his own life these concepts of Tao, Zen concepts, Sufi concepts, not from the point of view of religious belief, but from the point of view of techniques. As a solitary, he became clear, for example, on the idea of the Zen koan, idea of what constitutes a true and what constitutes a false problem. One hot day in July, when the weather was so overwhelmingly blistering, he could hardly breathe, a friend of his came out, a doctor, from Louisville, and the two men simply got in the car and drove around just to have the stir of the breeze in the car. They drove around and ended up passing the Sisters of Loreto at Nerinx, or Nerinx, I guess it's called. So they stopped in to see if they could see their old friend, Mother Luke Tobin. She wasn't there. They began to talk with the sisters, and they, in the terrible heat of that day, they began to talk about Zen. A great many people have suffered the illusion that when Merton became interested in Zen or in Tao, this implied in some way an abandonment of his Christian beliefs, which did not at all. They had come to embrace all of these things. And so he was explaining some of the value, for example, of Zen training to these sisters at Loreto. And he said, one of the things is that you always, when you work with a Zen master, you're always given a problem, a koan. And every day you are asked to come back to the Zen master and give him your solution to that problem. And every day you go back and you give him the solution, and every day he tells you that's interesting, but it's no solution at all. Come back again. And Merton was, he confided that his problem at that time that he was working on, or had been working on, was a problem of, to give an illustration, say you have a goose, a baby goose that is put into a bottle, and that goose begins to grow, and it gets too big for the bottle. How do you get the goose out without either killing the goose or breaking the bottle? And every day he would come with a solution, which was not the solution, until finally he would come to perceive this kind of training, that it didn't really matter what your solution was, because the problem itself was absurd. And in a solemn profession in choir one day, he got a solution. He said, he had it, the goose ate the bottle. It's a very poor, you know, it's no solution. But then the question didn't deserve a solution in any case. And he used this as an illustration to show that you don't need to waste your time trying to bring resolutions to false problems. And one of the sisters asked him, said, yes, but are all problems false? What about the problem of starving humanity? And he said, no, that's an authentic problem. That's a real problem. But what do we do? Do we attack the problem of starving humanity, or do we seek first a way to act that will show us as liberal, just human beings? And he said that we have thus taken an authentic problem and turned it false by turning it upon ourselves. That whenever we turn a problem in on ourselves, instead of universalizing it, it becomes a false problem. And in the religious life, of course, everyone who has any association with the religious life knows that it is filled with problems that can be considered false because they're turned upon oneself. And his whole point there, and the point which has a true reference to his life, was that you have to recognize the problem is false and then not even bother with the solution. Recently, at one of the symposiums held up at Mount Saviour, a Zen master was there, and he was trying to show this to some of the Trappist fathers that were there. One of the fathers went in and he said, my son, he said, are you a pagan or a Christian? He said, well, I guess, you know, unfortunately in your eyes, I'm a Christian. I'm an abbot, Trappist abbot. He said, no, it's not unfortunate at all. He said, all right, your problem is, tell me, how do you know when the song of the cricket unites you to God? And the abbot went, and next day he went with the solution. He says, I know when the song of the cricket unites me to God when I'm no longer aware of the song of the cricket. And the Zen master said, well, that's very beautiful. It's very beautiful, it's not the solution. Now you come back, you think about this, come back tomorrow. And you tell me, how do you know when the song of the cricket unites you to God? He went back the next day and he said, well, I'm still aware of the song of the cricket, but no longer aware of the cricket. He said, no, that wasn't any good. And I tried to get him the third day, because I think I'm probably one of the few people that ever resolved a koan. I tried to get him to go back and say, the third day, I know when the song of the cricket unites me to God, when I've taught the little devil to sing Ave Maria. Which may not be a sublime thought, but I think it's the answer to a koan. So we have these basic things that were interior, intimate, and private with Merton. There's the problem of the ideal self in contradistinction to the actual self. Merton got to where he dreaded to... He loved friends. I didn't mean to imply this. He loved friends. If he felt a kind of sympathy or empathy for you, he would do his best in justice to you and to himself to tear down this ideal image. He would usually do it by being very blunt, very coarse in his language, very earthy, to try to destroy it as quickly as possible, because he said he could not bear that ideal image. It was a role that he was expected to play. It was a mask that he was expected to wear, and he felt it was utterly false. And he would come back to that hill, and one time he said, I came back feeling as though plague-ridden, and finally I can be true to myself, because he said, the trees don't judge, and the sky is neutral. And this became a very important thing to him. How do you be completely true to your own lived reality? How do you avoid the falsity of trying to live up to expectations that others make for you and that aren't true to you? There was this question of the true and the false problem, which was a constant preoccupation to him. And I'm talking to you about his interior life, because in the realm of his studies, he was, you know, writing books constantly. He was studying constantly. He was leading an extraordinarily active life there. The last years, it began to crumble in a certain sense. People found out where his hermitage was. More and more people invaded his solitude. Solitude could be broken without hurting him if he knew and expected a visitor. But it was all of those who were constantly showing up, whose heads were appearing above the brush, who kept him more and more interrupted, less and less able to plunge himself into this experiential existence of his. The last year, he changed his whole schedule. So many people were showing up. Merton had great difficulty saying no to anything. If he saw somebody and they asked him to do something, he would say yes. He could be talked into anything. And again, he reproached himself constantly for this. Why do I go on letting people get statements out of me that sound as though we're gung-ho and we're right up there and we're right up to scratch with everything. Matt, last year he got a book on interlibrary loan from St. Bonaventure. It was in Latin, Rule for English Recluses of the 14th Century. And he relished that book. He relished every line of it, and then he had a guilt feeling about this, because he said, I'm disgusted, I have this kind of servile, guilty feeling because of my love for the mystics of the 14th century, when everybody more or less frowns on this in modern theology. And then he said, but isn't this the very meaning of solitude of the hermit life, that you are no longer subject to the fads and fashions? They would come back to that kind of liberation from all these fads and fashions. In that last year, he changed his life. He had too many interruptions. Strange people would come. He had become a very controversial man. He got a lot of hate mail. One day he went down to go take the car to see the doctor, and this was in 65, this was when they still had the sign language, and one of the brothers at the gatehouse made a sign to him, said, I'm glad that the man who came here to kill you didn't get to you. Well, this is kind of a disconcerting sign for you to be reading. And on investigation, it turned out that some of Merton's writings about racism had so incensed this man that he had come there, checked in at the guest house with a pistol. And fortunately, somebody had said something to him about Merton. He'd gotten so incensed and really got into hysterics and pulled out his pistol and said, I came here to kill the man. And they carted him off. But it wasn't the fear of that. It was the fact that a great many people longed just to meet him, a tourist attraction kind of thing. There were a great many people who really had authentic reasons to see him and meet him also. And so he would begin by doing now his work in the morning. And he would go out, he would fix his lunch. He would go out shortly before noon and spend the afternoons in the woods, in the forest. And then he would come in late in the evening, and he would come in a hidden way so that he was hidden from the view of the hermitage by trees. And he would stop and he would examine the territory. And again and again and again in his journals, he would say, I saw a car parked down at the foot, and so I waited until two disappointed looking men came and got in it and drove away. What I'm telling you this far is because this happened too much. And it led, after the election, after the retirement of Dom James, and after the election of a new abbot, Father Flavian, who himself had been a hermit, it led to a growing need to find some place where you could live with uninterrupted silence and solitude. Merton, through his friend Jean Leclerc, Dom Leclerc, the Benedictine scholar from Luxembourg, got an invitation to come and participate in a meeting of Asian abbots in Bangkok, Thailand. This served really as a legal excuse, as a legal reason to make a trip. The real purpose for that trip, or certainly one of the prime purposes for that trip, was for Merton to go and to visit spiritual leaders in India and in the East, with a view to finding some place that the abbey might procure as a place of hermitage, where monks might go for a certain portion of the more or less lengthy period of hermit life. That was the second reason, and really quite the important reason for the trip. He left in September, and he made a prolonged trip, ending up in Bangkok after many, many meetings. Those will come out in his Asian diaries, which will be published, I think, shortly after the first of the year. He was photographing immensely during that period, sending his films to us to be processed. On the 8th, he arrived in Bangkok. He went to, I believe it was called the Imperial, or the Oriental Hotel, I've forgotten the name, and he wrote a few letters. He wrote me, I didn't get it till after his death, and he wrote a few other people. In his letter to me, he asked me, he had just been for a visit with the Dalai Lama, and he had made photographs, and he'd sent them to me, I had airmailed the contact sheets back to him, and he was very excited about these, and he wanted to know if I would make a big, beautiful print and send it to the Dalai Lama with his compliments. And then he said this. He said, this has been a very exciting and a very revealing trip. But he said, I have not found what I came to find. He said, I have not found any place of hermitage that is any better than the hermitage I had at Gethsemane. I have at Gethsemane, which is, after all, a place of great graces. 2 days later, on the 10th, which was the anniversary of his entry into Gethsemane, 27 years prior to that time, he gave his address. A lot of you saw that last night on the Dutch TV. He gave his address, and then he was very tired, very overwhelmed by the heat. And he said, I understand there's going to be questions this evening. The somewhat romanticized version of his apparent last words were, so now I will disappear. What he actually said, as I'm sure you heard if you listened carefully, was, so since we're going to have questions about this, why, I'm going to disappear and let's all go get a Coke or something like this. His actual last words, as reported by Father de Grun, who shared the cabin with him, centered around the objections that were made to his talk by a French nun. Father de Grun described her as unfortunately one of those narrow-minded types of nuns. She was quite incensed because Merton was speaking some pretty straight truths this conference. And the implication that she got from it was that, we had better, which is, of course, the whole message of Merton's life, we had better stop talking so much about Jesus Christ and start being so Christ-like that the message gets across. In other words, we must become, we must be before we do. And she went to Father de Grun, furious, and said, our whole training has taught us that we must bring Jesus to the world, and here he's telling us not to talk about Jesus anymore. So Father de Grun went to a quite fatigued Father Lewis, Father Merton, and he told him what this nun had said. And so far as we know, this is certainly one of his last words. We don't know the exact sequence. He said, well, I didn't make myself clear. He said, what I meant, of course, was that we, it's now every man for himself. We are in a desperate situation in the world. We can't play act anymore. We have to be so permeated with Christ that we don't need to say a word, that the overflow of that will so fill our actions that the message gets across. And he went and he took a shower. He was not a very practical man. He came in and there was a long stand-up fan, a tall stand-up fan. And he was barefoot on a on a terrazzo floor, and he reached to turn that fan to his bed, where he's going to take a nap, siesta. He was heard to bellow, this great involuntary bellow that poured out of him. Brother de Groen heard it upstairs. He came running down the stairs. There was a Filipino priest who was staying downstairs in the section next to him. He was in the bathroom brushing his teeth. And so Father de Groen knocked on the door, banged on the door, and said, "Are you all right?" And the father said, "Oh, there is a sure, I'm all right. Why?" And he said, "I heard somebody bellow. I thought you were Merton." He said, "No, no, it wasn't me, and I didn't hear anything." Well, there was noise outside. They had such a reverence for his privacy that they did not check on him. And what had happened was that he had touched this fan, 220-volt direct current. It had wrenched this bellow from him and apparently thrown the heart into fibrillation. And he'd fallen with the fan on top of him. If they had looked in, the chances were good that they could have saved him. But out of respect for his privacy, they went away. And it was an hour later when they decided that something must be wrong. In fact, they even heard the smell of the burning flesh. And they went and peered through a hole in the curtain and saw him lying there on his back with this still live fan sizzling on top of him. They went in, and one of the abbots tried to lift the fan off, and he himself got such a jolt that he was locked to it, and somebody went over and unplugged it. One of the sisters at that conference was a medical doctor, a diagnostician from Vienna, who was then a superior in Korea. She came immediately thinking there might be a chance to save him. She gave him a quite thorough medical examination and pronounced him dead by electrocution. The laws in Thailand are special. They have a very special concept of death and a very special concept of saving face. They left the body as it was until the police came. The police came and at about 1 o'clock, at about 6 o'clock, they declared him dead and that it was an accident. And they allowed him to be dressed in his robes, and a group of the Trappists came in and said psalms around the bed. And then at 1:30 in the morning, Thai doctors examined him. For some reason, they did not want it known that there was a faulty fan in that place. Even though the police, and I have the police reports, sent that fan for examination, and it was came back declared faulty wiring. They pronounced him dead by fainting due to heart failure, which is an extraordinary kind of diagnosis. Dead by fainting due to heart failure. The minute this call came to Father Flavian, he realized that everybody in the future was going to be questioning this kind of this. So he said, "There's no history of heart problem. Please do an autopsy." They came at 1 o'clock in the morning and got the body. But the law in Thailand says that a body must be buried on the spot within 24 hours and cannot be shipped out of the country if there's an autopsy. So the Dom Rembert Weakland, who was the abbot primate of the Benedictine order and the highest ranking man there, took it on himself to cancel the autopsy. And Merton was sent back to be buried at Gethsemane, as he had always expressed the wish that he would be. There were some strange things about this, some very moving things about this. One of the things was that the American consul there went through all of his effects, listed everything that he had, and its approximate value. The list is fascinating, not only for what he had, He was carrying with him on his body 8 relics. No value. He had a Timex watch, which was valued, I believe, at $25. He had a camera and a lens, which valued at $30 or $50 or $75. He had one broken rosary, value nil. 2 Trappist ordos, used, value nil. This man who loathed and wrote so eloquently against the idea of the body count in Vietnam was sent back with a number on an American plane from Vietnam. Again, quite characteristically and in his own way, he was late for his funeral. Those of us who had been associates were immediately notified, and then we were kept notified that the funeral would be Friday afternoon, and then it was going to be Saturday afternoon, and then it was going to be Sunday afternoon, and then the body still hadn't arrived, and it was going to be Monday afternoon. And finally, I believe it was Tuesday, that the body did arrive, and a great mass was sung, and he was buried there at Gethsemane. I don't know how to assess the meaning of this man's life, which is one of the things that I've been asked to do here, because he himself would have thrown that kind of a concept completely out the window. He was, and what he did was the overflow of what he was. And that's pretty much as far as it went with him. He received in the last year of his life a letter from a professor at Smith College, Miss Eleanor Duckett. Name is maybe familiar to some of you. She was an authority, she's an elderly lady, she's an authority on monasticism. She wrote him an extraordinary letter in which she said how important it is. She was a specialist in the writings of the Desert Fathers, the patristic writings. She said how important it is that one man is doing this thing that you are doing, that somewhere in the world one man is doing this thing that you are doing, learning from solitude and silence what only solitude and silence can teach. And that evening, he sat on the porch, and he said he looked across the peaceful valley to the winter landscape that was starkly etched, cold, all in monochrome. And he saw what he was doing through the eyes of this letter. And he said, I realize how right this is for me. And he realized how rarely privileged a man he had become. I think had he lived, he would have become more and more silent, more and more unknown. He would have gone on writing forever, but I think he would have published less and less and less. He was headed into a very profound experience and experiment which would have synthesized for us the techniques of a great, great many religious disciplines. So I think what we're going to find, you know, if he would permit me to suggest that his life had any meaning, I think probably the most fantastic meaning it has is that he led a way which is now opening up to many others, is that he actually took the gambles and actually lived his vocation without compromise, without the kind of compromises that most men are called upon to make. He lived, in a sense, in a very profound sense, in an absolute way. A lot of people have questioned whether or not he had an authentic monastic vocation. A lot of people have questioned this and that and the other about him. Rumors about him are incredible. One of the things that we have to remember when we ask whether or not this or that was authentic about him was that after 27 years as a monk, he still spent 3 hours a day in secret prayer, and nobody ever knew what that prayer consisted of, not even his own confessor. These are rare things to find in a civilization and in a time like ours. And I believe that as these things come out, the ferment of this man's life will let us know what the meaning is. Thank you very, very much for listening so patiently and so quietly.